So, what's new? Peter Henderson asked. They were dining just off the hill, two acquaintances from New England, one a junior aide to a senator, the other a junior member of the White House staff.
It never changes, Peter, Wally Hicks said resignedly. The peace talks are going nowhere. I don't think there's ever going to be peace in our time, you know?
It has to, Wally, Henderson said, reaching for a second beer.
If it doesn't, Hicks said gloomily.
Both had been seniors at the Andover Academy in October 1962, close friends and roommates. Theirs was the fat and lazy time for American youth, all the more so that their wealthy families had further insulated them from reality with the privilege that money could buy without imparting the wisdom required for its proper use. The Bay of Pigs incident shattered that. Suddenly, they realized that it could all be over in a matter of seconds. Clearly, they realized they would have to find a way to change things. After graduation, their friendship and mission in life continued and grew as they went through the universities of Brown and Harvard, respectively, majoring in political science. And so now both young men had achieved their own entry-level positions in sensitive posts, both as aides to important men. In many ways, both knew more than their bosses did, and that, they thought, was fitting, because they often understood the important things better than their bosses did. It was all so clear. War was a bad thing, and had to be avoided entirely, or at least ended as rapidly as one could bring it about. Both wondered that so many people failed to grasp the simple clarity of the truth that both men had discovered in high school. There was only one difference between the two, really. As a White House staffer, Hicks worked inside the system, sharing everything with his classmate. But Hicks didn't know that Henderson had taken one step beyond him. If he couldn't change government policy from the inside, Henderson felt, then he had to get help from some outside agency that could assist him in blocking government actions that endangered the world. The first contact had come at Harvard, a friend in the peace movement. Now he communicated with someone else. But he hadn't told Wally yet. The timing just hadn't been right. It has to end, and it will, Henderson said. Vietnam will get the government it wants. We will have lost a war, and that will be a good thing for our country. We'll learn the limits of our power, and then we can give peace a chance.
Kelly rose after 5 the next afternoon, fully rested and alert. Having checked in with Greer and making an appointment for the following Tuesday, he was on his own. Looking in the mirror, he saw the heavy beard from 2 days' growth. Good. Then he selected his clothing. Dark, baggy, and old. A wig completed the picture he wanted, made of coarse, black Asian hair. He'd have to find a way to make it smell, too, Kelly thought. Nature provided some additional cover. 10 minutes later, he was buying a bottle of cheap yellow wine. Then, it was time to go. It all looked different now, Kelly thought. He drove past the spot where he'd led Billy and his roadrunner. He shook his head. That was the past. The future occupied his thoughts. Kelly was in the jungle, and again at war. He parked and quickly got out and headed into an alley dotted with trash. He took a mouthful of the wine and sloshed it around before letting it dribble out onto his face and clothing. He got a handful of dirt, rubbed it onto his hands and forearms, and onto his face. By the time Kelly had passed through the alley, he was just one more wino, like those who littered the area. He became deliberately sloppy in his movements, while his eyes searched for a good perch. He settled for an abandoned corner house with upstairs windows. He entered it from the back door and made his way up the unbannistered stairs and found the corner bedroom with the bay windows. He crouched at the windows, evaluating his field of view along each of the 4 main points of the compass. He took out a small pair of binoculars and began his reconnaissance. Friday night, the start of the weekend, and people were making their purchases. He identified one probable dealer a block and a half away. He and his lieutenant had a thriving trade, perhaps regular customers, he thought, watching both men ply their trade.
He assigned them the names Archie and Jughead. Down another street was a solo dealer who didn't have a lieutenant. Kelly thought of him as Charlie Brown. Over the next 5 hours, Kelly identified and classified three other operations within his field of view. Then, the selection process began. Dagwood was right across the street from the Wizard, and Big Bob was even larger than Kelly, and his lieutenant was larger still. Kelly wasn't looking for challenges, yet. He checked his watch, 3:20. Things were slowing down out there. One by one, the dealers all disappeared until the streets were empty. Hell began promptly at 11 that morning, though Colonel Zacharias had no way of knowing the time. Zacharias had never really thought capture would happen to him. Death, that was the chance and the likelihood he'd thought about. He'd reconciled with his God, knowing he'd lived in accordance with the teachings of the Mormon Church. But nothing could have prepared him for this nightmare of captivity, and he was completely alone with his fears. Then things became worse. The door to his cell opened. Two Vietnamese entered, looking at him with disgust. Zacharias tried to meet them with courage. They took him to a larger room, and the muzzle of a rifle stabbed hard into his back, and he gasped in pain. In a span of seconds, he collapsed on the concrete floor, feeling the blows and kicks in his agonized muscles, wishing it would stop, knowing that it never would. A screaming voice blasted through. He saw their faces cringe, looking toward the source of the noise. They hastily made their way out. The voice changed. It was a white voice. Strong hands lifted him, and the face came into view. It was Grisanov. "My God," the Russian said, his cheeks glowing with anger. "Drink, Robin. Drink this." He held a small flask to the American's lips. Zacharias took a quick swallow before he noticed the taste of vodka. Shocked, he tried to push it away. "I can't drink," he gasped. "Robin, it is medicine. Your religion has no rule against this. Please, you need this." Maybe it is medicine, Zacharias thought. Some medicines used an alcohol base, and the church permitted that, didn't it? He took another tentative swallow. "Not too much, Robin." Grisanov removed the flask, then gently tended to his injuries. "Savages," the Russian snarled. "I'll throttle Major Venn for this." The Russian colonel sat down next to his American colleague. "Robin, we are enemies, but even war has rules with these people. Do not understand honor." He held up the flask again, and Zacharias took another swallow, still disoriented and confused. "Good man," Grisanov said. "You are a courageous man, my friend, to resist these little animals." "Have to," Zacharias gasped. "I would too," he said, wiping the man's face tenderly. "God, to be flying again. Yeah. Colonel, I wish..." "Call me Kolya. You've known me long enough." Zacharias leaned his head back, closing his eyes. "Yes, Kolya. I would like to be flying again. My favorite was the MiG-17. God, what a joy to fly." "The 86 was mine," Zacharias replied. "They're all gone, too." "From one pilot to another," Grisanov said. "You Americans have had excellent bomb delivery in this wretched place." "We try, Kolya. We surely do try," Zacharias said, his voice slurred. It amazed the Russian that the liquor had worked so quickly. It had taken a few months, but he'd finally found something that worked. How distasteful that he had to live in this hot, humid, insect-ridden country, he thought. But the information he needed was here. And now he knew how to get it, he realized, listening to every word of the American's explanation of the life of a fighter pilot.